Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, I'm Steph.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome to The Food Fight, where we offer a different perspective on food culture issues around Australia and the world.
We'll talk with chefs, producers, business owners and experts to hear their stories and find out what makes them tick.
This episode we're speaking with John Raleigh from Textbook Patisserie in Sydney about his double life as a fine patissier and a wild game hunter. Let's get started. Welcome to another episode of The Food Fight. I'm Stefan Postuma, one of your hosts, with my co-host here, Simon Evans.
Hello.
And we're here with John Raleigh from Textbook Patisserie in Alexandria. G'day, John.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, guys, we start our podcast with an acknowledgement of country, and we're on Gadigal country here in Sydney. So we'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land that we are speaking and gathering here today on, and pay respect to elders past, present, and emerging. All right, guys, let's start the podcast. John, we're sitting here in Alexandria on a terrible, terrible rainy day. But for people who don't know much about Textbook Patisserie, give us a bit of an overview of what you do just to get started.
So Textbook Patisserie, I've had now, opened it up from the start, about five and a bit years now. Mainly, again, from I did my apprenticeship, a bit about myself, I guess, apprenticeship in the patisseries, but then was in restaurants for the last 15 years or whatever it's been, and always liked patisseries, but just wanted to, you know, I like the whole restaurant side of things as well, where they're always changing, and a lot of bakeries and patisseries you go to, it's kind of the same old, day in, day out, so it gets quite repetitive. So I guess opening my own place was being able to do whatever I wanted, so that was my ultimate goal, and change up things as much as I can.
Did you... Like, so you said you got your start in patisseries themselves. Did you sort of always know you wanted to work with food and be a chef?
Not really. It was, I guess, you know, there's no story bullshit behind it. It's just I never wanted to be a chef when I was young. I don't know what I wanted to be. Just got into it, mm-hmm. You know, left school, found a job. A few fell through and then end up in a bakery, so...
Right.
Yeah, that's how it happened.
And so what was your first job in the bakery? Were you just sort of like back of house helping prep and all that sort of thing? They say you want to do an apprenticeship.
Yeah, I did an apprenticeship. So yeah, okay. I pretty much, did a trial. And they're like, yep, we'll give you an apprenticeship. And luckily, I started off in a good patisserie, so I got good skills, good basic skills and good knowledge and understanding. So I went from there.
That's probably like key for anyone looking at taking an apprenticeship is your first couple of places you work are pretty key. I think that can set you up. I mean, especially like a lot of people do just... You're just like, oh, I just got a job there and just did it because I wasn't going to do anything else.
Yeah.
Like, I can really kind of make or break.
Yeah, I guess I was lucky. I didn't really do research. I just kind of like, it's close to me. And luckily, they were good enough. And he was an amazing boss. So, really pushed me to... I wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't because of him.
Where was that? Where, which?
Down the Southern Highlands.
Oh, okay. Is that where you're from?
Grew up around that area, yep.
Yeah, okay.
So,
cool. Which one was it?
The Gumnut.
In, where is it?
They got a couple of shops around there. They got one in Berrima, one in Mittagong Barrel.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's definitely a good place to start. Mm. Good old Gumnut. I made that a Southern Highlands cookbook a while ago.
Yeah, okay.
Had
Nico and all that.
Recipes.
James, and I think I saw that one.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Was there something about pastry in particular that sort of, as you said, you sort of went and worked in kitchens and things like that too, but always gravitated towards the pastry section and patisserie and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I guess I like the kind of artistic side of it. So I like that a lot, you know, decorating stuff and making things look pretty.
Yeah.
And I was always into a bit of art back in the day. So I guess when I got into that, it was like a bit more working with your hands and foods, yeah, just, you know.
I think you can see that like across quite a lot of things where people who are from an arts background or a creative like that, when they go into food, especially something like pastry, like you said, is very kind of aesthetic. They do excel with that just kind of eye for things.
Yeah.
So I guess the same with kind of a lot of industries where people from a kind of arts background go into it, but it seems like there's not too much of that in the cooking world, where possibly maybe because it's kind of more of a trade when you start.
Yeah.
Before you get to kind of do those actual artistic things, but it's definitely interesting seeing people as they progress from that kind of arts background.
Mm. Went full on with the artistic side of thing and did some competitions in Europe and all that sort of stuff. I'd like to just sort of briefly talk about that world, because it's a huge thing, all the sugar and the pastry competitions and all that sort of work that you can do over in Europe. I don't know anything about it. What's that like?
Yeah, so my boss from the Gumnut Patisserie did a lot of that back in the day, so he was always pushing you to do competitions to better yourself and so on. So that's where I guess I got the love of sugar art and chocolate art and all that sort of stuff, and building sculptures out of sugar and chocolate.
What's it like though? Like, what's the process of entering a competition? Do you have to like come up with like a concept like ages in advance and be like, all right, how are we going to put this together? How are we going to?
Yeah, a lot of it's all concept and a theme towards it, and then you kind of go from there.
I
guess I was just doing a lot of it in my spare time, and then a couple of people saw it and picked me up. And
how do you get you did some competitions in Europe?
Yeah, I've been a bit all over the place.
But
it's taken me all around the world. I lived in London for 5 years and in Michelin star restaurants and bakeries, patisseries, and a bit all over the place. But the competitions took me all over.
Mm-hmm. And how do you like have to transport all your gear and all that sort of stuff? Is this like a big logistical?
A lot of it was. We had a bit of a team that kind of organised all that sort of stuff, and worked with some amazing people, learnt some amazing things along the way. So
yeah, I think the kind of the cooking competitions in Europe a little bit different ones in Australia. They're very classical and old, even like the sort of savoury cooking competitions. The stuff they come up with is like pretty fucking wild.
Yeah,
like it's very like over the top, almost kind of. A bit too over the top, but it's all very artistic, very beautiful, but kind of not really realistic.
No, it's not.
it's a complete kind of game compared to cooking.
Some of those competitions I went to, and like the chef side of things and all that, it's all like plastic food. It's like fucking
it's not really edible.
It's not, and it's like that's what kind of got a bit over it with all that sort of stuff, all the politics and bullshit behind it. And
it seems like it's kind of an interesting to push yourself, test yourself. Yeah. Excuse to go and travel a bit.
Yeah, it was fun while it lasted, and that was it.
Yeah,
wouldn't want to spend fucking a week on a sugar piece now. Couldn't be fucked.
Is that how long they'd take?
Some would, like, you could probably do it. They do like a 8-hour competition, but a lot of the stages are done. I guess by the time you're thinking about something, get it all in place, make molds, and all the bullshit behind it.
Do you think that do you think that there's some skills and some things that you got out of that competition work? Because that's obviously a different level when you've got that amount of time to spend on something that you brought to textbook and like the pastry that you're doing now.
It makes you, a lot more organised, I guess. You've got everything in place. I guess it gives you that kind of, how to work faster or,
How to structure everything. Put everything in place and put a schedule and a system together.
But I guess restaurants were like that too, so it was kind of,
I see, like pastry, that level is kind of, is it more kind of art and engineering than a lot of anything else?
It's a lot of mold making and just thinking of how to put in things together and so on.
Mm.
Yeah, so I think you need a knack for it. Like, I can't think of much worse than spending my time like fucking with sugar. Like just generally, I'm just like.
It was fun when it lasted. Got obsessed with it, but then
Was there, because there is always that divide and almost most chefs will consider themselves kind of savoury chefs and not pastry chefs, which I think is a kind of bad way of looking at it. Like, dessert should be as important. There's obviously a limit to what you kind of learn, because you very much have to specialise in pastry. But have you sort of always just gravitated toward the sweet side of the pastry side?
No, I've done savoury as well. I've been in kitchens as a sous chef with a mate, actually, who I worked in London with. He came back and opened a restaurant here. It was Koi. It was a Japanese restaurant in Woolwich.
Yeah, cool.
Got the one hat there. It was kind of cooking all the savouries there.
Mm.
So I love cooking savoury. I just hate being in a kitchen.
Yeah, right.
Like, you know, day in, day out, working 18-hour days. And
yeah.
Which, you know, I loved it at the time. And London was like that. It was just full on. It was just, you never slept.
Yeah.
It was just work.
Yeah.
Mm. And so was the decision to open Textbook then, because I think this is something interesting to explore. It's like some chefs, like I guess the goal for a lot of chefs is to open your own business, right?
Mm.
And depending on the business model, like some chefs are in their own kitchens as much as you would be as if you were a head chef or whatever. Like, is the model of a patisserie like yours, like being able to put that together in a way that allows you to have a work-life balance and that sort of thing too?
Well, yeah, at first, when I first opened it, I was like, I was working those many hours anyway.
Yeah,
I was like,
course.
I may as well just do it for myself. And it was exactly that. And yeah, I still do have my weeks. Like, I'll push on if I have to, but I try not to.
Yeah.
I've just got good staff at the moment, so I try to keep that as good as I possibly and look after everyone so they stay with me and so on, and we can grow that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't want to work day in, day out for the rest of my life. I get out a lot, so...
Yeah.
As much as I can.
We'll talk
on my
about
days
it.
Off.
Just finishing off a bit more about what you do here, like, do you want to give us a bit of an explanation of the type of patisserie and stuff that you do here if people aren't familiar with what you do?
So I guess it's all kind of classic French techniques, but we try to put a modern twist on things. So yeah, using, again, local ingredients and so on. We use just anything and everything, whatever's in season. We'll just, change it up when we can. I guess we've been quite known for our kind of bicolour croissants and that sort of stuff, which kind of kicked off Textbook, I guess. The one we first started was like the truffle croissant we started, and that kind of got, you know, seen around a lot, so that kind of got us on the map and just went from there.
Mm. Why did you want to start doing these sort of a bit sort of out-of-the-box croissants and things like that? I guess croissants are a pretty big deal these days. Like, there's you see croissants in the media, and in general, like Simon and I were talking about it on the way up here, that like, especially on social media, there's this world of baked goods and patisserie lovers out there that are just into it.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, I guess I just got bored doing the same old plain croissant, so I was like, why? What can I do different?
Yeah.
So that's all it comes down to, I guess.
Really?
You go from there.
Simple as that.
Yeah.
Yeah,
do enough. Something different.
How interesting, because like, we've seen this. There's a lot of, like, Instagram seems to love baked goods, and you get a lot of followers, a lot of traction, or likes.
Yeah.
How much has that kind of pushed the business forward and helped you out? I think has there been a market effect of having these very Instagrammable pictures and then leading to more customers?
I guess that's where it all started, exactly.
Yeah.
It went off. I was doing little videos on my Instagram and that sort of shit when I first started. Not thinking anything was going to take off. I just do random shit all the time, like on and put it on Instagram. I guess it was seen and shared, and you know, that's when it goes viral and all that sort of stuff. And before you know it, it just went off. And that's exactly how it happened. It was just overnight kind of thing. It was like,
really? Yeah. So is there like a moment for you when certain things got shared, and then like a week later you had a line out the door and you're like, shit, what the hell is this?
Yeah, I think it started with that truffle croissant, but it was again, I only want to do it because I like truffling something different with croissant.
I know, so, it sounds delicious.
I like the fact, I think there's so many people when opening a new business, they're like looking for like, what's our Instagrammable dish?
Yeah.
I like the fact you were just fucking people try
too fucking hard.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's
it's
where you see all this over the top shit. And you know, I hate looking at it. It's like, they've just thought about this way too much. Just fucking.
Yeah, it's like the big stacked up fucking burgers.
Yeah.
Big stacked up burgers. And people like froth them. And it's like, that's a foot tall.
Yeah.
That's a fucking foot tall. What are you going to do with that? Okay. Like, you're going to take it apart.
But that's what they all say. Let's make it Instagrammable.
Yeah, like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, but.
What's Instagrammable? I don't know. Yeah,
I mean,
over the top shit.
The thing being is like you said, that like, if you can find something that is picturesque, looks great, that gets shared, that can have a mass effect in your business.
Yeah. And people go out there and just, like, they try too hard as well. Like, they tag in everyone possible so they can get the shares.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. So I guess there is a...
I try not too hard in it.
It's hard to tell other people, be like, so get an Instagrammable dish, but don't actually try and get an Instagrammable dish. Don't care about it. Don't try too hard, but definitely get one because that will help you. It's our advice.
It's true. A bit over the top, but okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't
know. Go to the top, but don't be a twat.
You see, it works though. Like it fully works. Like it, and if it's done right, like that muffaletta sandwich at A1 Canteen in the city. I remember when that restaurant opened, that's like all I saw on Instagram. I was like, everyone's eating this sandwich. Like, and it, like it looks great and stuff like that. But they did, like, I mean, how much social media attention can you get from one sandwich? Great. Like, I mean, well done.
I guess so, like it was like that for Chris from Blackstar. Strawberry watermelon cake. Like,
that was the one.
Fucking same shit. It was just, I don't think he meant to do it. It just happened. And before you know it, that's all he's selling.
Did you find like you get this weird, like, people sort of then know who you are via Instagram, and you're getting DMs and you're getting like influencers approaching you
all the time.
Fuck. Do you get like, so something that Simon and I follow quite closely is Couscous for Comment, Jonathan Lethlin's like calling out of influencer or influencers. Do you get a lot of that sort of stuff?
There's been a few issues with those. So again, didn't end well, but I haven't had any for a while.
Yeah, okay.
So I usually just tell them what I think.
Or just buy your croissants.
Well, I've had one guy in here I remember quite well, and he was like, "Oh, you know, I'm here, I'm going to do this." I'm like, "I don't give a fuck who you are. I'm like, you can pay for my fucking dessert." Some people are just fucking special.
Yeah, exactly. They're probably, in some worlds and some, like, in clothing, like, having some, like, a popular influencer can make a massive difference to your business.
Yeah.
I mean, like, do you think there's maybe more of a, like, restaurants, I don't think there's too much of a knock-on effect, like, when you have, like, an influencer come in and take some pictures, but do you reckon in pastries where that Instagram following can make a big difference?
I think it does, like, for the right
person. We still want to give, exactly.
Yeah, and for the right person, if, you know, but they usually come in, they buy their stuff, and then they tell me, you know, they don't go there asking for free stuff.
Yeah,
you know? And they're the ones that usually make the difference. And, they do it on their own back and promote me, and then I'll promote them after that.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
And there's a lot of good people out there doing that. So, but you do get your tosses.
Yeah. That one for, what was it?
I Try Too Hard Again.
Yeah, one from Bulletin Place is like my favorite one.
Oh, the Bulletin Place guy that was like, you're like, irrelevant bar or whatever. Yeah. Like, yeah.
They changed it. Change their bio to like irrelevant bar. Sydney.
Yeah, we need to get John on the podcast and just discuss this issue as a whole podcast because it's hilarious.
Yeah,
but yeah, it's an interesting one though. Like, I mean, it's an interesting analogy you make with fashion and stuff like that, because like now, I guess it's different depending on, you know, what your organization is, but like every, you know, fashion label that is like reasonably like successful, social media partnerships are a part of their market strategy for all new products and things like that. It's just weird that in the food world, it's like people approaching chefs. Like, it's like, if it's a part of your marketing strategy, you go out and you find these people that will be an asset to your business. But it seems weird that in the food world, everyone, like all these influencers, can sort of think, hey, we love your, like, croissants, we love your food, like, come and give us a free meal. And it's like,
the difference is the people who, like, the ones you see in Couscous for Comment are literally just like, they've gone to like Melbourne and they just want to eat for free for a weekend and stay at some free hotels, so they just pepper everyone with a message
and someone's gonna reply back.
They've got no interest in actually helping your business.
No, they ain't give a fuck.
Can't give a shit at all. They literally just want a little free night out.
Yep.
And it just gives them more content, you know, they can put and be like, look, I'm an influencer, like.
It's a weird world on Instagram.
I mean, it is a strange one, especially like it's something that's only like, you know, this wasn't part of our apprenticeships.
Instagram 10, 15
years ago. It's like, so like, this was not an aspect of anything that you knew about or even like learned from, you know, like my old head chef was fucking useless on social media.
Yeah.
So it's not even something like you could learn from something else. Like, you know, people who are owning businesses right now, we're very much learning on the fly of how the fuck this works.
Well, it was like that when we first opened. Like, I hated Instagram. I kind of went on it just for the business, but I was trying to run it myself as well. And then I guess when things did take off, I was like, oh, fuck. Like, you know.
Yeah.
And you did see how it worked. So I was like, well, you know, it is getting people at the door. Yeah, and it really did work. It was like, but it was, it was a weird one.
Yeah.
But I never thought, you know, that was ever going to happen.
Do you think that there's an issue? Do you think, like, Simon, I reckon we've got to do a podcast just about Instagram and its influence on food culture in the food world, because it's been massive. And, like, do you think that there's an issue with a lot of businesses out there who might have the best product and like the best service and the best restaurants. Like I've made cookbooks in, you know, four different regions of New South Wales with everyone from high profile chefs to people who, no worries, Simon, always bigging you up. But like for example, you know, I'll just use Sharif Kaya from the Ottoman in Canberra as an example. He is a Turkish bloke, been running that restaurant for like a couple of decades, maybe 30 years or something like that. It's had a hat for God knows how long, and now and it's had two every now and then and things like that as well. But you just do not see it on social media because like it's just one of those traditional places that's just, and like, are we in this weird place now where to be a relevant restaurant you actually have to have social media, or are you gonna like and sort of be really active on that and be a part of the conversation on Instagram, or like are we at risk of sort of losing some of these really genuine interesting places that are run by someone like Sharif who has absolutely no interest in social media, but like they just sort of fade into obscurity a little bit because they're not on Instagram and they're not like part of that culture.
There are a lot of restaurants like that that just tick over and they're busy and, you know, they don't exist on Instagram. It'd be awesome if I didn't have to do that as well, but it was, I guess that's where it just ended. Mm. Like, it's nothing I set out to do. It was just, didn't think anything was going to take off. I just, you know, did it just because you did it.
Yeah,
because
you're supposed to do it.
And then,
I mean, I think possibly kind of, I mean, ethnic restaurants are the kind of ones that they wouldn't have this maybe this knowledge of social media. And you see those sort of small little gems around who don't like might have a Facebook that gets updated once every couple of weeks. But I guess there is kind of a missing out. But also, I think people on the flip, people like discovering that little space, that little spot that's not on social media, it isn't kind of blowing up.
Yeah,
and people quite like that.
Yeah, but that is like so word of mouth is still sort of strong enough to keep you busy, like, and that sort of thing. Like,
I mean, busy enough maybe to do like one thing. I think like if like next restaurant I end up doing, I think like the visual and social media is definitely something I'm going to take more account of. And making sure, you know, your social media presence looks great. I think it can make a difference. And you know, whether that's you get someone else to do it or you learn more about it yourself, I think it's just it's going to be quite important and probably more important going forward. Especially if people are just still going to be scared to fucking leave the house in over the next couple of years, like they're going to be looking online about where am I going to go to pop out and go back home, or where I'm going to order from, you know, from my house.
Well, that's it. Most people are getting Deliveroo and all this crap these days.
Yeah, exactly.
You
know,
I can't say too much. I get it, but it's like it's against everything I believe in. And
was that a consideration at all?
People have hit me up to do it. I'm not doing it. Fuck that. I don't want to.
Yeah.
Rather get bankrupt.
Yeah. I mean, from a financial, from the fact they take so much, or from quality kind of view.
Yeah, they just take so much. What percentage is it at the moment?
So we were with Night Parrot through like lockdown, and I think Uber Eats was 35 and Deliveroo was 30.
It's fucked.
Like it's pretty big. Like you get your like statement in the week and you'd be like, oh, fucking hell. Yeah. Is that how much we lost? Like, you know, lost is a funny because like, they do get you orders.
Yeah. It's everything these days. Like, we've got a couple of systems, but if everyone takes their little percentage out of you, like you're left with fucking nothing at the end.
Exactly, imagine, the margins on pastry got to be pretty tight, or is that...
Well, yeah, as well. Like, everything's gone up, you know. Yeah, ingredients cost thing, then it's labour to do it.
Because everything's quite labour intensive. There's not much at the end of it. That's kind of the hard one to track is labour when you're pricing something. I think that's something that restaurants and everyone needs to look where the future is. Like when you're going, I need to charge this much for it. And you're going, you know, how much does it cost to keep the lights on? How much is like the rent? How much the ingredients?
Especially in Sydney too, like you can't really go too crazy because everyone, you know, there's price range as well. A lot of bakeries around Sydney, so you try to all be on the same mark.
So no
matter what you're trying to do different, it's like, well...
That's quite an interesting one where things get, like, capped at a price, and as soon as you go over, like...
People abuse you.
That can make an article on its own, like, it's charging $50 for a croissant.
Well, I think... who was it? I think it was Penny? Penny Falls?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. She was charging, I think, $6 a croissant, and it blew up. Everyone complained. Like, it was wild. In the paper and everything. It was like, fuck, I should charge $6.
$6.
Yeah. Made me think about it.
Like, how long has a coffee been capped at, like, $4.50, exactly. $4.90? Like,
it goes up to $4.80.
If you go above that $5 mark, you'd be like, oh, it's expensive.
Goes over $5 and people, like, complain.
Yeah. Like,
fuck.
It's like that through history, man. I worked at my mom had a chain of sandwich shops in Canberra when I was growing up, and we were the first place I'd ever seen that cracked a $10 sandwich, and people literally were just like, "What the fuck is this?" Yeah, and it's like, you don't have to buy one.
They'll be back tomorrow. They'll be back tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you do not need to eat this sandwich. Yeah. Like, you can go find a sandwich at the servo for $2.
Make your own.
You
know. Are other sandwiches available?
We did roast this beef, like marinated overnight, and then roast it for you and all the rest
of
it.
So funny when people think like that. And then people get like an uproar about like wage theft and stuff. $6 croissant though, fuck. Yeah.
It's like this entitlement to be able to pay what you want for something. It's like, you go to a shop and there's a pair of jeans that you want that are more expensive than you're willing to pay, you don't abuse the people for saying, these jeans are $150 and I've only got $100.
Yeah.
You're like, well, no, you just can't afford them. Like, if you want them, buy them. If you can't, don't. Simple.
Yeah, I always find that funny.
Let's talk a bit about how COVID's affected your business.
It's been a weird one this year. It's like we had all the bushfires, that kicked off. That was last Christmas before.
The blaseness of chefs and hospitality industry, where it's like this fucking global pandemic, and everyone's like, been a weird one.
Yeah.
it's been a weird one.
Yeah, it's been a bit odd, like I do as well. Strange year.
Yeah, it was weird. Like, we've got a lot of Chinese customers, Asian customers, so, yeah. And, coronavirus started. When did it actually start? Like, it was November.
March. Oh, like, well, over there, well, yeah.
Yeah, and then, Chinatown was dead, because I got a mate who's got a bakery in there, and it was dead. It was a ghost town. Like, people were freaking out way before all this crap came in and benefits and so on. But it affected us earlier, but, prior to that.
Right.
So
Yeah,
nobody wanted to come out. That's when it really started kicking off, I guess. And then, that was going on. The bushfires were going on as well, the whole city was covered in smoke and whole of Australia was burning. So nobody wanted to fucking spend money. Everyone was depressed, and then COVID really kicked in. And then it was just it was fucking one thing after another, and it's been quiet. Like, we had a lot of wholesale as well, doing bars and pubs and restaurants, so that all went. So, and then I just kind of relied on people coming in. Luckily my landlord was good, so they gave me a 3-month kind of free rent.
That's been so big.
There's been a few good things that have happened out of it. So, I could have got fucked. I've heard a lot of people have been fucked from there.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, there's so many places which it's like you're made or broken by your landlord 100%. And how nice your landlord is, right, essentially.
Yeah.
Like,
100%.
Yeah.
And that's, I was lucky enough, I guess, on that side of things. So, I'm still here. I didn't think I was going
to
be.
Have you made any changes to the business, or are you sort of looking ahead thinking in this new weird world that we're in? Like,
everyone kept going, you got to change. I'm like, well, I'm a baker. If it doesn't fucking work, it doesn't work.
Well, that's the thing.
Like, there's only so much you can change a bakery and doing takeaways. And like, it's a fucking bakery cafe. It's a, I make cakes and bread and fucking.
Yeah.
There's, only so much you can do. Mm. So, I didn't change anything.
Keep pushing along.
May cut back on a few staff, but it was good on those sides. Like, I think I was a bit overstaffed at the time, so it made me kind of clean up a lot of my shit. So
maybe you got a bit of time to do that too at one point.
So there were a few things we've got to clean up and really come out of it. Well, still coming out of it, I guess. We're just
still here.
As I said, this weekend just gone has been weekend we haven't had like that since God knows when.
That's
so awesome.
It was good to see.
That's great.
Finally
cool.
Coming back to normal. It all seemed pretty chilled as well, not just busy, but it was quite everyone kind of kept their distance, and it was never too crazy. It was pretty crazy. There was a line at the door all day, but
Is it annoying? Is it hard to manage that, like, as a, I mean, we've talked to chefs and I've talked to Simon on this podcast about how it's been implementing restrictions in a restaurant environment, but like, what's it like for a place like this with a lot of people, a lot of turnover, heaps of people coming? Is it hard to
Well, as I said, that was the really first time that it happened since God knows when.
Yeah,
but before that, it was kind of just normal, would do these croissant weekends or something special, and it would get a bit of a crowd happening. So it all seemed fairly well on the weekend, I think. Haven't had any complaints yet, but it's only Monday, so I'm sure I'll hear something.
That's good. All right, well, we'll start moving on, but the last thing I want to ask about pastry is, like, I want to talk about croissants. Is there something in particular about croissants? Like, it just seems that, like, there's certain things in cooking that people get hooked on, and that they turned into this like project on how to like perfect a certain thing. And like, was there something that hooked you about croissants? Like, it seems like it's almost like a, you mentioned the word engineering before. It's like a engineering and creativity sort of mixed together.
I guess it was one of those things because, yeah, since I guess when I opened, like, I'd always done a bit of croissant here and there, never really full on. So I guess when I started croissant, it was like, always kept trying to perfect it, make it better. You know, changing it up on a weekly basis, just seeing what I could improve. And yeah, I guess it became an obsession. I just had to keep going and trying to do different stuff to, yeah, really perfect it. Which I still have problems with it now. Like, it's always still up and down, but it's always, can get back on track fairly quick.
Yeah. Well, so, what gives you the downs? Like, how do you, after all your experience, how do you, have a day?
Letting someone else do it. But, yeah. So, but the guy I've got at the moment has been quite good, consistent. So, yeah, we get to improve as well. So.
Right.
But, yeah, there's always slightly changes, especially because we're using sustainable flour plus some organic stuff through whole grain milling.
Yeah.
So it does change in seasons. But it does. So, and you do see it. Like, you know,
so what's
months.
The difference? What's the seasonality difference in the flour?
So some of them will like absorb more water, some of them won't. So you get a little bit variables like that. Other times it's, yeah, some flours I've used that have just been, there's no structure in them, they just fall apart. It's like, but this flour I've got at the moment that I'm using has been really good. But it, as I said, it does slightly change, but you can adjust to it fairly quick. So
yeah, I think like bread and paste like that is quite good for obsessive personalities, which a lot of people in hospitality have, that like that little 1% making that big outcome in the end, and also just the fucking, you know, the mind-numbing part of when your ingredients are slightly different in a slightly different time. Because like bread making, they said like the absorption rate of things can just completely fuck your loaf, and it's a tiny little thing that's going to drive you nuts, and getting that consistency is kind of what you want.
Especially when now we're coming into summer, like we've seen it change like overnight. Like it's like fuck, and then we're just going to adjust everything, I guess.
Your timing, especially here when it goes from like, oh, it's quite cold to, oh, fuck, it's boiling. Yeah. Like, at least in the UK, it's like consistent kind of temperature and you could just adjust your times and stuff a little bit.
Yeah, but you don't want to be there, though, so.
Well, oh, yeah, fine. No, I'm here. I'm still going to fucking complain about it.
Classic English, that is.
All right, well, moving from the finesse and, you know, almost the science of croissants into like when we look at textbooks in Instagram as compared to your personal Instagram, John, textbooks full of colorful, beautiful croissants, and your Instagram's full of big dead animals.
Beautiful art.
Yeah. How did you get into hunting? Like, were you a fisherman first or a hunter?
Yeah, I've always done a lot of spearfishing, like growing up. My old man would always take me out.
Yeah. Where was your sort of coastal home base?
It was around Wollongong area.
Right.
That's where I'd do a lot of it, but my old man was living up Foster, so I'd go up there a lot. And now I guess I live in Bondi, so I'm in the water as much as I can. Every good day that I get home and it looks good, I'll get in.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fishing was it, started. But then I kind of grew up with a friend who had a bit of property, so was hunting from about 15 or 16. Would always kind of go on those trips, like every year, that would go out to a mate's property and go, you know, hunting, and became a bit of a ritual. Like every year, every Easter, would go out and do that. And then it just, I got older and wanted my own stuff and wanted to do it more, and love the food's the best part about it. And I guess because I've always been in kitchens and, you know, restaurants and bakeries, so it's like it's yeah, everything you could ask for.
What like you're starting hunting from, say, like the age of 15, I think. Well, firstly, let's like start off with the premise that, like, I think potentially hunting's not misrepresented, but maybe misunderstood by some people, right? Like, it's one of the, like, if not the most, one of the most sustainable ways to acquire food, like, out of anything out there, aside from maybe growing your own veggies or something like that. Was your decision to go hunting just like a thing because you had friends that did it and you wanted to do it? Like, when did the sort of sustainability aspect start to become important to you?
I guess the more I worked in kitchens, the more I kind of, you know, had more kind of thought about the food. I guess when I first started hunting, it wasn't really about the food. It was more about just getting out there and enjoying the bush and walking around with the gun on your back and shooting animals.
Yeah.
But it progressed to food.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sweet. And so, well, let's. I want to dig into it because I don't know like too much about hunting. But like, so where, like, how does one start hunting? It seems like a thing that's like hard to
get into.
I guess
it's one of those things. It's like either you watch something and you want to do it. But yeah, I was, as I said, I grew up always spearfishing and doing that sort of stuff. So hunting, I always had in the back of my head I wanted to hunt. I don't know why, I just really wanted to shoot deer and eat deer.
And so is that mostly what you go out and target, deer and that sort of stuff?
Pretty much. But I went out the other week, just targeted bunnies and so on. And I'll go target, depending on what time of year, I'll target different animals.
Yeah.
I like a variety in the freezer. So
yeah. And so do you, like, is meat that you've hunted yourself the majority of the meat that you eat at home?
100%, yeah.
100%?
I still like my good steaks and that sort of stuff, but a lot of it, my freezers are full of fish and crabs and lobsters and meat. I like everything tastes better when you've caught it yourself and cooked it yourself. I think, you get to see the whole process where not many people do understand. Mm. You've butchered the animal, you've done the whole process.
Mm.
So I think seeing that all the way to the end is just, I don't know, you just get a good reward out of it. You
I think it's quite hard to get particularly good fresh game from suppliers. Like, a lot of time it comes in frozen. It's something that's kind of piqued my interest. Not I've ever gone out hunting, but from that point of view, I'd be able to get an animal from the point and be able to then treat it the way I want. Yeah. That seems like an experience to be great, and having that consistency of having your own meat then. From a kind of quality standpoint, do you see like it's that much better when you've kind of hunted it yourself?
Yeah, for me, 100%. Mm. Just everything, all the way, the whole process is, from start to finish is just amazing for me. I like the whole butchery part of things, and I guess just self-taught butcher.
That's
but a lot of chef mates as well that have taught me, so I can't say self-taught all the way.
Yeah,
but
I mean, just animals like are quite similar.
It's pretty straightforward,
you follow bones along, butchers even do all
exactly
that?
All the work's kind of there, you just kind of run the knife down it.
But it's kind of like that. Like, I remember we got like a whole kangaroo in a couple of years ago, and it was like, obviously it's something I'd never butchered before. It was quite a different kind of protein, but it was just very much like, this is kind of like a pig or a lamb or something, and you just go and find the same seams and things.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm. And so where, like, being from the Southern Highlands originally, is that where you began hunting? Is that the area where you
started? I was
going
out past Orange.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and I still go there now.
Yeah, okay.
Been going there for 20 years or plus, property.
And so what type of deer and what type of species are you looking at?
Out there was, you had a bit of everything. You had pigs, rabbits, kangaroos, deer. I guess the most common deer that I shoot are fallow.
Okay.
And everything's introduced species from England or someone or Europe. So there's a lot of bit of an uproar about that, that they should be culled and blah, blah. So
yeah, I think the thing with deer is in Illawarra there was like fucking deer on the beach.
Yeah, exactly. The rooster deer, and the Royal National Park's full of them.
Yeah,
but we're not allowed to hunt it because it's national park.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And in Victoria, you're allowed to hunt national park, but New South Wales.
Yeah, do you want to talk about that? What's like, because I was talking to a friend who's done some hunting down in Victoria.
Yep.
What's your opinion on this ability to hunt national parks or not?
Especially when, we're paying all our taxes, we're paying our licences, our fees, everything we need to do to have a gun licence, we're putting money back into them, and then they fly up choppers and try to kill all the bloody deer and leave them dead on the ground, the DPI.
And is that what happens in national parks?
It happens everywhere, yeah. It happens where I hunt in around the Upper Hunter. They'll go and kill them all, but they won't use anything. You're not allowed to bring them back and, use them. We're not actually allowed to use them.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't understand it. They're a pest and they're introduced species, but they just don't... I don't know. It's a weird one. It's like they're trying not to, let you use the game or get free food without paying for it or something.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that you can't... Like, someone who's just hunted something couldn't bring it to a restaurant and sell it to them, or you couldn't even use it in your own restaurant.
Exactly.
There's a lot of regulations around it, especially when something is an introduced pest and they're multiplying massively. Then it seems like there's an easy solution that we can just fucking eat the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Forget his name, who does that down in Tasmania. Vincent Trim, I think his thing is called Eat the Problem. And yeah, he fucking eats everything.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the way to go. I mean, and there's something like... I mean, yeah, venison is delicious. It's very healthy. It's
and
very good
people
for you.
Don't understand it. It's like, you can't eat that. It's like, why not?
Oh yeah,
it's like you've got to try to talk. It's like it's some of the best meat you can get.
Yeah. Especially in Australia, when there's like there's so much space, and there's not too much pressure on them, so they can live these like very healthy lives in the wild, and it, like there's a lot of kind of propaganda and some stuff about like. About they can have worms in them and things like this, yeah. But it's you take a risk when you eat any animal, and like, would you rather the antibiotic pumped up fucking chicken and hormone fed beef that's allowed in this country, or this this meat sauce that's just grown in the wild?
Yeah, well, it's like that. Like when you my brother is got a bit of a hobby farm, so we ate some of those chickens, and it's like compared to the stuff you buy in the supermarket, it's like. You can't even compare them.
Chicken's the most marketed one. You can show someone so if you, much, yeah, if you have a good chicken, and not even the breed they use for meat chickens, where they're bred to have massive breasts and no legs. You see a different breed of chicken. Like it's like a different animal.
Yeah.
Like the legs are so much bigger. Like the breast is kind of more sloped and then skinnier. Like it looks like a different animal. Mm. Like it's quite scary.
Yeah.
Do you know Because I've seen, I've read some things about the debate in New South Wales as to whether or not we're allowed to hunt in national parks. Do you know what reason is given by DPI, that we're not? Like, is it four-wheel drives getting in there and destroying the landscape and that sort of thing?
I don't actually 100% know the whole detail, but it's weird, but we're allowed to do it in Victoria.
Yeah.
I've got my Victorian licence because I'd prefer to go buy a licence and go, there's less rules down there, less regulations. Like the DPI in New South Wales... if you want a state forest license, you've got to go do surveys and everything. So you go do the surveys, and they'll be like, okay, there's plenty to do there, we'll go kill them all.
Yeah, right.
So they want you to do all these surveys for them to help them out, and then they decide, we'll cope.
So is that how it works in New South Wales to get a license? Because I'm interested. You have to get a gun license, but then you also have to get a license to be able to hunt in a state forest.
That's if you want to go down that way. But if you've got private property, you just need a letter from the owner just saying that you shoot the feral species on that property.
Right.
And you don't have to join a gun club that way, which that's what I do. So
right.
I got a couple of letters. I don't have a state forest license.
Right.
I've got the Victorian one, but that's...
So you can hunt on private... But how do hunters then... if I was to start hunting and I don't know anyone that's got private property, do you kind of just get involved in the community? Or
there's clubs and you can join. Yeah. And that's another thing with Instagram. Some people I've met over Instagram with hunting that kind of are all great people, and, they just spread the word and you get invited out to places. That's actually been quite big in hunting as well, Instagram, I think.
Because it'd be quite a solo adventure for some people as well, so there wouldn't be too much community involved in it.
Yeah, yeah, a lot of people just do their solo things, but I like to always go with a couple of mates.
Yeah, yeah.
So through Instagram, you like meeting people I've got a property out here and we've got X, Y, and Z species on the property, come out.
Yeah, you get a lot of people that kind of keep it to themselves and don't like to share, but you meet some good people that, and especially down in Victoria and that sort of stuff a lot, where you can... It's all open land. You can go hunt wherever they let you.
Mm.
You don't have to book in. You've got God knows how many, places to hunt there. It's just unlimited.
Mm.
It seems like there's a lot of hoops to jump through to get started. I remember Tom, my business partner, he had a friend who was big into hunting, and Tom quite gets onto things and normally kind of follows through to the extreme. But he kind of got stopped at hunting when I think he got to all the, you have to get this license and then this thing and that thing. And even for someone who's quite obsessive, that kind of stopped him in his tracks for actually going any further with it. So he still has not been hunting yet with his mate, who he promised he'd go hunting with.
Yeah. A lot of work to get
I met some good people along the way, and they've kind of, and I still hunt with one of them now, which I hunt with mostly. Mm. I met him at a chef's dinner, just drinking beers one night. And
you're right.
Been hunting ever since.
Maybe people have this conception that people enjoy the process of killing an animal, that there's some sort of sadism involved in hunting, where it's I just want to kill stuff. But
I think you get a few people like that.
There's probably are people like that, right? Yeah.
I usually think about what I'm going to cook with it before I shoot it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's something in my head, but it's not about killing it first. It's what I'm going to cook.
Mm.
And then if I miss, I'll usually pissed off at myself. I'm like, fuck. I'm going to cook this and now I fucked it.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of quandary is, if you're doing it purely for, I want to kill an animal, that's a bit weird.
Yeah.
And, but for a food resource and for that kind of, being out in the bush and that kind of time spent out there and feeling kind of a, bit more connected to land, I think that is a as a pursuit is kind of a good thing. And even I was looking at your Instagram yesterday with my vegan girlfriend, who's a big fan of textbook, and didn't know you hunted. She's a pretty good vegan, but yeah, she was like, "Oh, it's quite it's quite confronting, isn't it?" And I'm like, "I think it should be."
Well, that's like it should be confronting. That's what people don't know. People don't know, and they think they can just buy it out of a plastic wrapper, and they think they don't have to think about the rest.
Exactly.
And it's like, but yeah, the amount of arguments I've gotten into over Instagram and everyone giving me shit. It's like, well, but then yet they will eat meat, but they don't know what goes into it, and there's probably more torture in these abattoirs these days that you hear about, and you see as documentaries out there and all that sort of shit. Those people that are working in there are fucked up people. Like, that's they thrive on fucking killing shit. Like, they're probably mass murderers down the track somewhere.
So, I think it kind of people. Yeah, like I said, people just get very shocked by it. And it's like you eat this. Like, this is the form it's in. Like, it was an animal, and I think people need to understand that. And I mean, I think. That will go a long way to people possibly eating less meat by understanding that, you know, there is a death has occurred here. For you to have this, we should be respectful of it. We should eat the whole animal. We shouldn't be just eating, you know, tenderloin and fillet stuff the whole time.
That must be a big part of hunting too, right? Is like eating the whole beast.
Well, you can get everything out of it, the heart, the liver. Like, it's some of the best stuff there.
Yeah.
And then, you got all the meat. There's so much on there as well. So,
What's your favorite? Like, what's your favorite cut of whatever game animal that you might regularly hunt?
Favorite cut? Probably be the venison. Like, there's a cut inside the back leg. It's like a loin. It's like my face. It's like, looks like a veal almost. It's got that lighter color to it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's my favorite part of a deer.
And that one's nice and tender, like straight on the barbie or straight on the grill.
Hang it for a couple of weeks anyway.
Most of a deer is pretty tender.
Yeah.
Like the only bit like the shin, you know, the shank is the only bit I've ever braised venison, and it's still not. Like, you have to add a lot of jus back into it to make it kind of juicy and braised. But the rest of it is very lean, very healthy meat.
Exactly.
Cool.
I think that was the first time we were trying to source kangaroo liver, and that was the first time I realized that you couldn't actually, even from commercial hunters, you can't have wild offal. It's illegal to serve,
right?
Because you can't track their diet, so there could be, again, something in there that could be harmful. Apparently,
yeah. I think depending on what animals, but kangaroos, they eat grass. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But how bad is it going to go?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'd still give it a go.
Pigs, I understand, because they'll eat meat when they can and so on.
Yeah, exactly.
And they're the ones that you kind of.
Yeah, that's like that slightly similar biology to us, where there can be transfer of disease and stuff. But yeah. Yeah, we want to get some kangaroo liver. We want to make parfait.
Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah, venison liver parfait is pretty good as well. Yeah, so all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, again, and you just can't get these things. And again, it's another cool resource.
Yeah, so like game offal, you literally cannot buy unless you hunt.
Yeah, unless
that's the best thing about it as well. Like, some of the meat you get, it's like you can't buy it.
Yeah,
yeah.
And that's I think that makes it feel a bit more special as well, especially when you're cooking it. But every barbecue I have. I've got friends over that have never eaten it before, and I'll always cook it at a barbecue, and they'll be like, "What's that?" And be like, "It's venison."
Yeah.
Where do you get that from? I'm like, "Shot it. Here's a photo." They're like, "Oh." But I like doing that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And it changes some people's, minds. Instagram again is one of those worlds where everyone just wants to press buttons and abuse you for killing animals, but it's like, well.
The worlds are colliding. The world of pastry collides with the world of hunting with you, John. People find you through textbook, and then they realize you're a hunter.
When all this thing kind of did happen with textbook, and things went viral, but everyone started following me. I'm like, what the fuck's this? Like, it was an overnight thing. I had to turn the phone off. I had people getting around abusing me. Oh, you murderer. I'm like, you fucking press the follow button. Yeah, fuck off. But it was like, overnight, like the amount of just abuse came in. I'm like, you fucking followed me. I make cakes and pretty croissants, and then they come onto your page, your personal page, and it's like, well, he kills animals. It's know anything about me. So,
like, fuck, how do you think I got that meat for that pie in the fucking village?
You ate the fucking thing.
That's a wild thought for that.
Is that sort of shit hard to deal with? Like, I guess having Instagram and I guess social media has sort of created this transparency in hospitality industry where people know the chefs these days. Like, before Instagram, before social media, it was like you read about chefs through, Good Food, Gourmet Traveler, whatever publication you read, and you might see a photo every now and then. You might have heard of Tetsuya or like whoever, because that's the name of their restaurant. But now, like, you know who's behind these successful venues. Is it like, is it draining? Is it like, fuck, I wish I didn't have to deal with like people
at first
getting up in my shit, basically.
Yeah, at first, when it all did first kick off, and everyone kind of pissed me off, and I was like, you know, always abusing back, and I would always abuse back, you know. And it was like, now I just don't give a fuck. I'm just like, whatever, fucking delete.
Yeah,
I'll get into an argument every now and then just to, you know, get into an argument. And it's like, just what you feel now like I just don't really care, I'll just delete it. So I fucking move on.
But yeah, like, it can be a worry, like saying that Instagram, like, you know, social media is so big that.
Yeah, some people, it just affects them, they can't handle it. And, oh, it
was,
you know.
When we first opened Kavo, it was pretty tough. Like, I mean, not something we'd dealt with directly. And like, obviously, we didn't get any particular backlash or. Yeah, the old bad review here and there, but like it would be like we'd be like when we first opened, we were checking reviews like every couple of days on every app, and eventually I just had to like blanket stop doing it.
Yeah,
because I was just like always just checking.
Oh,
and, like,
reviews. Yeah.
And you get 10 good ones, and you'd be like, okay, cool, everything's fine. And you get like one half bad one, you'd be like, what the fuck is this? And that would be like only thing you're thinking about. But we got a little bit of backlash. We did a spot on Studio 10, and we cooked kangaroo, and we got some backlash from these like anti-kangaroo groups. Anti-eating kangaroo groups, and they like left like bad reviews on the Facebook. Like,
but people go out of their way just sent to emails, fuck you,
like,
fuck with you.
Yeah, it's gone off on Twitter and stuff, and like, and it was one of those things we were just like, and I think I know, I had another one with like a local vegan page shared like a wallaby tail dish I did, and it started kicking off, and then like some Aboriginal woman kind of piped back and was like, no, it's blah blah, and they ended up taking the whole thing down. It was just like, that was weird.
I did provoke it one time. I think it was World Vegan Day. And I did do a little post. I think it was like 300 comments later. It was fucking went out of control. I was like, Jesus Christ, it was a joke.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Some people couldn't handle the joke.
It's pretty easy to get people riled up, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's that thing of... I mean, it does kind of... It does change like what you might post and what you might not. Like, there's been some posts that like... I mean, you can get to a point where you're just like, I don't care, like, we've got a customer base. But if you know, most people are kind of ticking along and you can't, you do have to worry about what you post and what effect that might have and whether that's going to piss some people off, you know, offend someone or whatever it is. And it, like, it can become a bit of a minefield of trying to navigate.
I think it has, well, on my personal page mainly, like, it started off like really bad, but now just like, now I think the people that are following me know.
Yeah.
So it's like, well, I don't cop the amount of bullshit I used to cop. Like,
yeah, right.
There might be occasional one or two here and there, but it's like, from what it was, to everyone abusing the hell out of you, to now it's like, oh, okay, maybe I'm training them.
Yeah. You filtered out the ones you're going to complain.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want those followers anyway. I don't really care.
Yeah.
So, except it's not the business, it's my personal page. So
it's an interesting thing. Like, it's just this, it's this weird contradiction in a way too, where people will abuse people on social media to make a point, right? So, like, they might be really passionate about the environment. Cool. Like, I'm passionate about the environment, we're passionate about the environment and sustainability, and we all integrate different things into our lives to try to push that forward. And then the same that comes with animal rights, like, people might, you know, have really solid, like, you know, just at the heart of who they are, they just really care about animals and whatever it is. But like, there's no compassion when it comes to the psychology of the people that you're interacting with online. It's like, you can be like compassionate for the environment and compassionate for animals, yet you'll go and really fuck with the mental health of someone online. And it's like, what about compassion for like people? I understand.
Some people, are definitely like, would rather...
Going out to close your business. They would love that.
Yeah.
Like,
some people fucking, next level like that. Mm. They don't care. Like, it's weird.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a weird contradiction, isn't it?
Yeah, legit, some people are like, I mean, that's why people would leave bad reviews for something like that, is because they want other people not to go. And therefore, for your business to suffer and probably close, like, that's pretty fucking, pretty tough on anyone.
Yeah.
Like, if you're going out to do that, that's pretty fucked up.
Yeah. Mm. I had one of those actually, and she actually said, like, this is when I was running the Instagram, which is probably bad for the business.
Has it been taken off you now?
Yeah. Pay someone to do it now.
Yeah. Right.
It literally, she goes, I'm gonna tell everyone about this. I'm gonna, you know, because she bought a croissant. Left it out for fucking 3 days. It went sour. She took it to work on Monday and complained and wanted her money back because I supposedly gave her fucking sour croissants. And it was like, And she went to the news and everything and put it all over. It was like top of the news that night.
I read that it was when actually, I was prepping
it went
for this.
Out of control. It was and she said
you had a go at her though, didn't you?
She said all this to me first.
Yeah.
She goes, I'm going to fucking badmouth you and your business and this and that. Right. Like, and fuck it. I gave her 110%, mate. She went, she did the effort. It was fucking good on her.
Yeah.
But, yeah. Yeah, it was fucking.
Any publicity is good publicity, John.
Well, that's what I said.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, especially when it's like, you got to stick to your guns.
Yeah.
And when it's obvious, someone like, I think like, people run that. And
she told me like, if she'd left it out.
Yeah.
And then she brought it back to me and she said, well, nobody told me. I'm like, it's a fucking bait call. Should be eaten on a day. It's common sense. It's why is it fucking up to my front of house staff to let you, not tell you to keep it for a week before you fucking give it to friends?
I mean, we also didn't tell you to leave it out for 3 days.
Your staff should have told me. I'm like, well,
just like tell you all the things you shouldn't do.
And she was a food blogger. She should fucking know better.
Exactly.
Wow.
That's not
a good look for a blog.
Yeah, yeah.
If it's like she didn't realise to keep a pastry.
I thought I won on top of that one. I definitely came out better.
It
did bring the business down a little bit after that.
Yeah, really?
Right. And a lot of people give me back, how dare you call the... I'm like, I'll just send them screenshots of what she was writing to me. There you go.
Yeah.
So your friend is a cunt. Sorry.
The life of a business owner. And now you are... You no longer run the Instagram. last question about hunting and about pastry. Like, hospitality is a hectic industry and, you know, stressful. How much does being able to go hunting or diving level you out, be able to sort of provide that balance? Because I think that especially potentially running a business in the city, like where me and Simon are from a regional place where we've got a lot of space and it's easier to connect with nature and kind of, you know, Simon does a lot of foraging. I spearfish myself and fish and stuff. I'm not a business owner, but not a hospitality business owner. But is that like really, really important for you?
For me, 100%. I don't think I wouldn't be where I am right now if I didn't do that. And I've always done it, so it's come natural to me. So I find the time, I make the time, and I do it. And come back from a hunting trip, back to work, you're just refreshed. You can think straight. But the weeks you spend sometimes in the kitchen where you're just like day in, day out. You get fucked, you burn out, and it's like, you know, seen it, been there. But yeah, getting back out in the kitchen, getting out of the kitchen, just foraging, whatever, you know, just being outdoors. Doesn't even have to be hunting, it can be picking mushrooms or whatever. It's just anything, just staying out in the bush overnight. So getting in the water, same, it's all just gets your head out of that kind of zone where you're not thinking too much.
Yeah, it's definitely something we've always shown our chefs, like what we're going to forage and, you know, change the seasons, where to find it, and then we'll sort of leave it up to them to go out, even if, you know, they're 20 minutes later for work because they've gone and picked up some stuff they need for their section. But I think it's it kind of all ties into better well-being, especially after we did a podcast on mental health, and the focus the guy put on like getting sunlight every day was just something I was like, maybe that explains some things. Like, yeah, it's like that 10-minute walk to work is the only sun I get all day, and then it's leaving as it's dark. So
there's some restaurants I was working in where you'd always get the ferry over or something. So it's like, it was actually just quite refreshing, just simple things like that.
Yeah, in the UK, it's very easy to go to work and it's dark in the morning.
Oh, 100%.
And come home from work and it's dark.
That was my whole time in London, I think. And that fucked me, but it was like 5 years of just 16-plus hour days. Yeah. And just, you dream about work, you just work.
Yeah. And I mean, again, it's harder again in cities, especially in London, where it's very dense, to actually be able to find any, you know, any greenery, any kind of patches of grass that's not fucking full of twats. So it's something we've kind of always focused on, is showing our staff to how to forage, and they can go out and get stuff. And I mean, one of our ex-staff has a little foraging business now. I think we showed him his sort of first step. So it's kind of cool to see that people carrying on.
Cool. John, is there anything coming up for textbook, coming up for you, that you want to make us aware of before we wrap it up?
Just business as normal.
Yeah, there is another thing in the pipeline at the moment, so might be opening something else, but we'll see what happens.
Mm, okay.
So, but that's, we'll see.
Stay tuned. Let us know.
Mm. Yeah.
All right, guys. I think we maybe leave it there, right?
Yeah, cool.
Thank you so much, John. Cheers,
thank
mate.
You. Thanks
Cheers.
For having me.
Hello, dear listeners. Steph here. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of The Food Fight. If you want to get in touch with us, it's at The Food Fight Podcast on Instagram or thefoodfightpodcast@gmail.com. We want to hear from you and we want to talk to you. Please leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps. If you want to hit me up, it's quicksandfood.com or at quicksandfood on Instagram. And if you want to get in touch with Simon, it's simon_evans_TBD on Instagram. Thanks so much for tuning in and we'll catch you again with another episode.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.